Welcome to Hub Headlines. Today's program features the best commentary and analysis published in the Hub for April 1st. Up first is Anthony Anderson, writing on NATO, the most important alliance in the world, turning 75.
April 4th, 1949. Canada signs the North Atlantic Treaty. They said they found his body around 6:30 in the morning. He lay in his pajamas, smashed into cold winter stone. The Soviets said he had jumped out of the third-floor bathroom window of his apartment. Friends and colleagues knew in their bones he had been pushed. There, at the age of 61, in the courtyard of Cernan Palace, which housed the foreign ministry in Prague, lay the corpse of Jan Masaryk, the Czechoslovakian foreign minister. It was March 10, 1948. The communists were busy turning the country into another Soviet prison cell. Masaryk's murder stunned an entire generation of diplomats who had met him over the years when he was the ambassador to Great Britain and a delegate at the United Nations. In Ottawa, senior PMO advisor Jack Pickersgill described a kind of real conversion that day in the official Canadian mindset. Prime Minister William L. M. King was horrified. Lester Pearson, deputy minister at External Affairs, what we called our foreign ministry then, had worked alongside Masaryk on various United Nations assignments. He was a magnetic personality and a delightful person. I had this feeling about Czechoslovakia through him which made it seem a little more frightening and real than it might otherwise have been. Looking back in retirement at this moment, Pearson noted, fear is usually, in international affairs, the greatest incentive to action, and certainly fear was established when the Russians moved into Czechoslovakia at that time that they might move right across Western Europe. He didn't mean move militarily but rather slither through subversion, infiltration, coups, tampering with elections, the nasty under-the-radar stuff. There was so much fear in the air that diplomats got very creative. In the months before Masaryk's murder, we had been the first official voice to speak up, publicly, about a potential response to the encroaching communist darkness. In September 1947, External Affairs Minister Louis Saint-Laurent stood before the General Assembly and told the United Nations out loud what everyone knew. The World Organization was incapable of holding a global peace because the Security Council, reflecting the Cold War schism, had become frozen in futility. Since the United Nations couldn't keep all its members safe from aggression, Saint-Laurent urged the United Nations democratic and peace-loving states to consider creating their own regional defense alliance. This was a very middle power approach. Find strength in numbers. The first member of a Western government to publicly advocate this concept, Saint-Laurent's appeal was lost in the noise. His mistake, if we can call it that, was to act slightly ahead of the curve. Ottawa would be compelled to wait, as it so often must, for more powerful allies to intervene. British Foreign Secretary Ernest Bevin had been mulling over the tenuous state of European defense, increasingly anxious about the Soviet threat and a potential American withdrawal into its reflexive isolationism. In January 1948, he sent an official appeal to Washington and Ottawa, essentially calling for what Canada had already proposed a few months before. He said, "We must organize and consolidate the ethical and spiritual forces of Western Europe backed by the power and resources of the Commonwealth and the Americas in order to create confidence and energy in our friends and to inspire respect and caution in others. Canadians cannot afford to be huffy about these unintended slights. The stakes are often too high." Already on the same page, Mackenzie King agreed to discuss the idea. Canada did not want to be stranded with the American behemoth on the North American continent. One-on-one, our hand would be so much weaker. We needed allies to leverage and amplify our voice. Nor did we want a world where the Americans and British weren't in lockstep on defense. Canadian and British officials understood they were asking the Americans to overturn deep habits of mind and make an unprecedented peacetime commitment to a military alliance. The first months of 1948 provided all the momentum needed to keep Western diplomats, pulled in many directions, on target. Communists seemed poised to do well in the looming elections in Italy and France. The Norwegian and Danish governments were so alarmed they would be forced into signing a friendship agreement with Moscow. They sent out a diplomatic SOS. Then the communists sealed their hold on Czechoslovakia. 12 days after Masaryk's murder, Pearson joined British and American officials for top-secret talks in the depths of the Pentagon to begin shaping an alliance of democracies. So we there were, right at the spark, in a privileged but familiar position, earned by our military, economic, and diplomatic contribution in that astonishingly creative period, where we had huddled together so often with the British and Americans in an inner working group putting together the United Nations' Food and Agriculture Organization, the UN Relief and Rehabilitation Agency, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the International Civil Aviation Organization. Meetings flowed into 1949 in a number of capitals as more countries kept joining in, complicating the issues and expectations. Old colonial powers like France, Belgium, and the Netherlands wanted their colonial interests protected. This was anathema to Washington. France proposed the treaty last for 99 years. Washington wanted 10. They settled on 20. Europe wanted American troops stationed on European soil so they would be implicated at the start of any Soviet attack. American officials were hemmed in by the congressional grip on the right to declare war. But whatever the frictions between allies, the Soviets continued doing their bit to ramp up larger fears, like blockading Berlin to bring the divided, besieged city to its knees. Canada created its own set of complications. During the talks, Pearson began to conceive of the new alliance as something more than just a military arrangement. He wanted, in his more exalted moments, something approaching a social and economic union. He cautioned, wisely, that military alliances never last beyond the emergency which gave rise to them, and he wanted this alliance to outlast the current emergency. The British and Americans, in their own wisdom, did not want negotiations to get bogged down with side issues, especially when the fate of the continent seemed to hang in the balance. Focused on the current emergency, they did everything they could to dilute and demolish what became known as Article 2, the Canadian Article. Pearson played hardball and suggested that Ottawa would feel compelled to publicly blame Washington for the defeat of Article 2. He even hinted that Canada might have to withdraw from the alliance. He eventually managed to secure a measure of, albeit reluctant, support from Britain and true sympathy from France, Belgium, and Holland. Canada had a decent stash of diplomatic credit with Washington, and so the superpower, with some grumbling, compromised and allowed an innocuous version of the much redrafted article into the treaty, which could mean as much or as little as the members would tolerate. Article 2 still declares that members will seek to eliminate conflict in their international economic policies and will encourage economic collaboration between any or all of them. Over time, it would prove to be little more than window dressing. Pragmatic as ever, Pearson accepted the dilution as better than nothing. It was all we could expect, he wrote in his memoirs, which perhaps is not a bad outcome for a middle power. In retirement, he confessed that NATO never became the organization I hoped it might be. I had no illusions about this. Perhaps like Saint Laurent in proposing the alliance, Pearson was too far ahead of the curve. The heart of the North Atlantic Treaty remains Article 5, which declares that an attack on one is an attack on all. Pearson's Atlantic vision would eventually come into being with the birth of the European Union. Yet for all the disappointment, Pearson himself and many historians would come to acknowledge that NATO was his greatest diplomatic achievement. This was the hard shield that made sure other Western foreign ministers weren't thrown out of windows or thousands of innocent people weren't marched off to die in prison camps to suit the Soviet idea of the good life. Over the course of the last 75 years, NATO's relevance and even its raison d'etre have shifted in the eyes of the people it serves. In this current emergency, with Russia, so true to form, attempting political and cultural genocide in Ukraine, NATO once again suddenly seems like a rather good club. Just ask the Swedes and Finns who ditched centuries of neutrality to come on board. Just ask the Ukrainians desperate for the shield we take for granted. Just ask John Masaryk.
That was a commentary by Anthony Anderson. He is a senior fellow at the Bill Graham Center for Contemporary International History. You can find the full text of his article on our website, thehub.ca.
Hi, Hub Podcast listener. Fun fact to share with you. Well, not really. Thanks to growing government intervention into the news media, the next federal election will be covered mostly by journalists whose salaries will be majority funded by one form of public subsidy or another. Yes, you heard me right. Here at The Hub, we think this is bad for journalism and bad for news and information consumers like you. And this is why The Hub will not be availing itself of these government subsidies. But producing high-quality independent news and analysis is expensive and time-consuming. And this is why we are asking you now to become a Hub subscriber for as little as 25 cents a day. Get all kinds of great benefits, including subscriber-only analysis of the economy and politics, podcast content, and so much more, all with the knowledge that your support makes our independent journalism possible. Sign up now at thehub.ca.
Our second essay is by David Warren, writing an ode to The Idler, Canada's eccentric literary conservative magazine.
Blackwood's Edinburgh Magazine, an eloquent voice for the old Tories, came into being around 1820, when Mr. Blackwood fired the rather hopeless editors and took charge of the monthly himself. The MAGA, as it came to be known, was meant explicitly to compete with the Edinburgh Review, the darling of the Whig establishment, which seemed to have been in power forever. The MAGA did not waste time. It promptly set about making itself obnoxious and winning the outrage of respectable, Whiggish intellectuals in London and elsewhere. Christopher North, the nominal, pseudonymous editor, said this about Francis Jeffrey, his illustrious review rival editor. "He hates me, no doubt, in a small toothy way, as a rat hates a terrier." It was with a similar desire to be naughty and offensive, and perhaps also sophisticated and spiritually Tory, in the face of Canada's perpetual liberal and progressive elites, that The Idler was founded at the end of 1984. It took its name from the periodical essay of Samuel Johnson, and by a crazy coincidence, the presses rolled on our first issue on the 200th anniversary of Dr. Johnson's death, precisely to the minute. This we realized only several weeks later. This attitude was clinched by our motto, "For those who read." Note that it was not for those who can read, for we were in general opposition to literacy crusades as, instinctively, to every other good cause. We once described the ideal Idler reader as a sprightly, octogenarian spinster with a drinking problem, and an ability to conceal it. It was to be a magazine of elevated general interest, as opposed to the despicable tabloids. We, myself and the few co-conspirators, wished to address that tiny minority of Canadians with functioning minds. I was the founder, and would be the first editor. I felt I had the arrogance needed for the job. I had spent much of my life outside the country and recently returned to it from Britain and the Far East. I had left Canada when I dropped out of high school because there seemed no chance that a person of untrammeled spirit could earn a living in Canadian publishing or journalism. Canada was, as David Frum wrote in an early issue of The Idler, a country where there is one side to every question. But there were several young people, and possibly many, with some literary talent, kicking around in the shadows, who lacked a literary outlet. These could perhaps be co-opted. The notion of publishing non-Canadians also occurred to me. The idea of not publishing the ABC of official Canlit further appealed. We provided elegant 18th-century design, fine but not precious typography, tastefully dangerous uncaptioned drawings, shrewd editorial judgment, and crisp wit. I hoped this would win friends and influence people over the next century or so. We would later be described as an elegant, brilliant, and often irritating thing, proudly pretentious and nostalgic, written by philosophers, curmudgeons, pedants, intellectual dandies. There were articles on philosophical conundrums, on opera, on unjustifiably unknown Eastern European and Chinese poets. We struck the pose of 18th-century gentlemen and gentlewomen and used sentences that had subordinate clauses. We reviewed heavy books, devoted long articles to subjects such as birdwatching in Kenya, or the anthropic cosmological principle, and we printed mottos in Latin or German without translating them. This left our natural ideological adversaries scratching their heads. Finding readers turned out to be a snip, as we were at least potentially entertaining. It wasn't entirely necessary to pander to vulgar tastes, only to write mischievous headlines. Our idle, philosophical attitude was consistently joyful, not ideologically grim. Thus, we had a huge advantage over the local competition. But the Canadian media economy was set up, then as now, to perpetuate grimness. There were no subsidies for joy, but instead penalties for thought crimes that evolved into today's political incorrectitudes. Interestingly, our artists, whom we cultivated in the same way as our writers, were loyal to the idler for the same reason. There was no other place where they were wanted. Nothing much has changed, with the possible exception of technology, in the 4 decades since. The Hub is among several online presences in conflict with the brain death that continues to constitute the Canadian identity. It is one of the tiny cells that is twitching. By luck, after producing the first issue entirely at my own expense, and distributing illustrated handbills to promote it, I awoke one morning to discover that literary editor William French had actually given the magazine prominent, enthusiastic coverage in the Globe and Mail. He was an old-fashioned liberal, after all, with an open mind. Soon we were selling more than 1,000 on newsstands, and had the largest foreign circulation of any Canadian magazine, I recall, thanks to 5 readers in Buffalo. Over the next decade, we gave many Canadian writers their start and elevated a few foreign big names. We also attracted, for a while, an intelligent furniture manufacturer and Holocaust survivor, Manny Drukier, who had the clever idea of starting a pub downstairs from our Toronto office, in the building he owned. This way, he reasoned, he'd be able to recover the modest wages he paid us. It was like putting up a sign that read, "Interesting people, please assemble here." It also secured the curious intrigue we had instigated between Catholics, High Anglicans, and Jews, who were more welcome in our liquid environment than fashionable atheists. While the Idler pub certainly helped on the revenue side, we still had a wee problem, which was making a profit. Although we were circulating in excess of what any Canadian literary magazine had ever done, we still carried no advertising. The book publishers, whom we thought would be our natural market, went to some trouble ignoring us, as we multiplied reviews and read and remarked. They were, of course, themselves chiefly dependent on the Killjoy, the Canada Council for the Arts, and other institutions of the vacuous left, which also were not giving us any money. We hit a little gold mine with a house advertisement that declared, "Subscribe to Canada's 97th Best Literary Magazine," because 96 had received generous grants from these government cultural agencies. Only the Idler and the Chesterton Review, then published out of Saskatoon, were spurned. Later, to shut us up, they gave us some chump change. Through Mr. Drukier's efforts, however, we received ads from several of his industrial suppliers. I designed the mottos and typography. I still remember my masterpiece, Mampy Screw Works, none better. Check it out. The client had declined memorable screws. Then we invented Idler to Idler, a section of classified ads at the back of the magazine which suddenly appeared, at Manny's suggestion. I made up the first few dozen implausible entries. For instance, I've got Spanny. You had him tied to a pillar at Dufferin and Bloor. Leave $250 in Druxy bag at Greyhound Terminal Locker 6, or Spanny is no more. Or we met on Lufthansa, fell in love at JFK, lost each other at Terminal 1. Please call Jerry and Bromley. Even these received jocative responses, and by next issue we received some genuine small ads, for which we had to assign genuine pigeonholes. We also launched the imaginary Thelma Fowler, an opinionated small advertisement manager, who was just one of the products of our ingenious copy editor, Elaine Duffy. The style caught on wondrously. The leading section was, of course, Amours and Companions, but miscellaneous literary and scientific requests suggested plenty of readers had been starved of community. I estimate that, through Idler to Idler and the Idler Pub, we were responsible for quite a few marriages as the 80s moved along, mostly between the sort of couples who would prove fertile, and whose children must be approaching 40 today. But swelling the population had not been among our initial purposes. Towards the end of 1993, all our little debts were called in with the chickens, and we went tits up. There was one last sad Christmas party in the Idler pub. I haven't invidiously named a few of our young contributors because several have managed to survive and even prosper in the liberal and progressive mass media since. They have done so by abandoning the character they had once displayed and, I think, selling out. Still others have blown away with the winter snow. Even the stalwarts, with the passage of time, die one by one, like my patron Manny and my co-editor, Gerald, just the other day. May they rest in peace. Aside from such appalling facts of life, was the experience worth it? It was. Given world enough and time, would I try it again? Of course I would.
That was a commentary by David Warren. He is the founder of The Idler. That's it for today's edition of Hub Headlines. We hope you enjoyed the program. To receive all our best commentary and analysis each morning by email, subscribe to The Hub for as little as 25 cents a day. You can do that right now at thehub.ca. Hub Headlines is produced by Alicia Rao. Thanks for listening.